Hi, this is Christoph, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to the podcast Learning from Leaders. And today we have a great leader here with us in Hergiswil in the Telex office. It's Lance Little. Lance, thank you so much for taking the time for being with us. I know how extremely busy you are.
That's an absolute pleasure, Christoph. I'm looking forward to the conversation. So, yeah, thanks for having me.
We just met a couple of weeks ago in Singapore, and you shared with me your extraordinary leadership journey and your recent achievements in collective leadership. To introduce you here to our viewers, you're obviously the managing director of Roche Diagnostics in Asia Pacific.
Yes.
Of course, a part of the world which is moving so strongly forward in general, but also in your work. Almost half of the population in that region, spanning from China, Japan in the north, all the way to India.
Yes.
They're now largest nations in the world in terms of population. Pakistan and, of course, Australia and New Zealand, where you are born.
Yep.
So looking forward to that discussion. And well, you hold responsible for more than 6,000 people now.
Yes. Yeah.
You are a great leader. We will talk a little bit more about that in a couple of minutes. Now, I was wondering if we would now ask your parents. Was it obvious from the beginning, from the early day, the small lands in a school or at home, that you were a born leader? Or is that something you had to learn step by step, or a mix of it?
Well, Christoph, that's a tough question out of the blocks. I would say no. My own perception, I don't know what they would have said. But no, I don't think so. As a child, I would say I was just sort of vanilla, if you like, or just go with the flow. I don't think there was anything particularly extraordinary about my journey. I was very fortunate. I grew up in an environment in New Zealand where, you know, life is good. As a schoolboy, you know, school, for example, is something that's it is an inconvenient reality between, you know, fishing and playing sport. So I think one of the things that I would say about my upbringing and the gift that perhaps my parents gave me is less about driving a journey through life, but more about never believing there were barriers.
Mm.
And if I reflect on my career, I think that's one of the foundational elements that have sort of allowed me to do some very unusual things through my life and of course my career journey, which is sort of a bit of a foundation as to the way I think and operate. But no, I don't think that my parents saw leadership in me. Maybe they did, I'm not sure. But perhaps it did start to manifest itself a little bit on the sports field from some coaches who sort of saw something in me and gave me additional responsibility in the early years.
And obviously till today you're very sportive.
Yeah, yes, it stayed with me, yes.
Well, great thing your parents passed on to you that idea that there are no limits and you can really manifest your dreams. That's wonderful.
I wouldn't say that was an active articulation either, but in reflection and retrospect on your life as you get older, I realized that the concept of barriers to doing things was never something that I thought about to the extent of, you know, my early life as when I was still training in biochemistry. We had a young family. I was 23. My daughter was born. We needed a place to live. So we built a house. Now, I was not a builder.
Yeah.
But again, this perhaps naivety of not living with, oh, well, I can't do that because that takes a certain skill set. Well, no, it's somebody can build houses. Why can't I, sort of thing? And I think that sort of manifested itself a lot through my career as well. You know, perhaps being comfortable doing things that others may not. And then maybe that then, if you think about that, perhaps creates a leader, somebody standing out perhaps from the group or taking a different pathway from the group that others may choose to follow.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that's a sort of a retrospective lens on it. None of that was planned at the time or anything like that.
Definitely. Already your story now has an influence on me and makes me think what were my limitations, right? You did not know that you were not able to build a house and therefore you build it, right? And passing that on to the people you're responsible for is definitely great. And you have built something extraordinary now in Asia Pacific. for yes. Roche. Were there later on maybe important stepping stones for you?
Oh, without doubt.
Yeah.
To become a leader. You know, influences. I was very fortunate when I joined Roche in 1995. So I've been with the company a long time, and you know, I had a great general manager by the name of Graham Watt, and he's still a good mate of mine, and I still see Graham as a mentor. But what he did, which I've never forgotten the lesson, is he gave me opportunities to expand my experience set such that when perhaps the next job came up or a particular moment in time when they asked me to go to Thailand as general manager, he'd been building me up so the gap was manageable from the role I had then up to my first general management role. And I've always, in hindsight, appreciated that opportunity that Graham gave to expand my experience set and set me up for whatever the next thing may be. And that's something that I encourage all of my leaders in the organization to do for their teams also.
So
there's moments along the way and people that have influenced for sure.
And so from that child you once were to the leader you are today, you evolved so fast and the world is also evolving so fast today. Many believe the world has never changed as fast as it does today. And there's the point to be made right back in 1920, the average lifespan of an organization was some, whatever, 67 years. Now we are down to 15 years.
Yes.
It is believed that about 90% of all data ever created on this planet was created just in the last 2 years.
Yes.
And yet maybe it would be fair to say probably the world will never ever change as slow as it is today.
That's true, yeah.
And I think Roche early on saw that coming, that now even in the pharma industry, even in diagnostics, the game is changing.
Yes.
And you have engaged in an agile transformation very successfully, right? At the end of the day, Roche was the company which created during the corona crisis the first corona test. I mean, that's testimony to it.
Yes.
Can you take us a little bit through that? What led to that conclusion and how did you go about that agile transformation today everybody speaks about?
I think it's important to understand that Roche is an organization, I think we're 127 years old now. To last that long at all generations of the organization over that time, there has to have been shifts and a willingness to shift and change as a future direction moves. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I think, especially within healthcare, there's a McKinsey study that talks about in 1950, it took 50 years to double the amount of healthcare information. Today, it's 72 days, right? So yes, and this is the world we're operating in. I think the agile transformation or the shift that we've taken over the last number of years across Roche, and particularly in Roche Diagnostics, has been one where we acknowledge that no longer can you be a static organization. And if you want to change, you change the shape of the house to become a different shaped house, but it's a house and it's static. The evolution that we've been through is very much around shifting the mindset to be able to create an organization that has structure and an operating model that is relevant for the moment, but with the fluidity, not chaos, but with the fluidity to allow us to shift and move as this healthcare environment and indeed the world around us shifts and moves. So we can look and see what's around the corner and move towards that rather than wait until it's sort of right here on our laps. Mm. And this is something we're still working through, in all honesty. And then with Agile itself, I think the way I view it, Agile is a tool set. Mm. And it's a tool set that took us a bit to work through. But it's now something that sits beside us. And as we want to pick up these tools and utilize them, then that helps us to evolve in a day-to-day leadership way, but also to deal with the challenges that the healthcare system needs us to deal with. So it's a little bit in the DNA of Roche that we do keep evolving, accepting the fact that that's not easy for people. We, as human beings, really don't like change. Very few of us do. And an organization is a collection of human beings. So, but I think this understanding over the last number of years within Roche, has really sort of embedded and helped us grow, actually, to I think, an organization that is well positioned for whatever will appear as we move around the next bend in the road.
With Telex, I had the pleasure to work with leaders at Roche. I had the pleasure to work with you back in the day in Australia. And for me, it is truly inspirational, actually, to see that level of sincerity, I think, in the way Roche goes about in that transformational journey. Because as you're saying, right, everybody likes to talk about changing the organization, but can I change?
Yes.
And how do I change my mindset? Yeah. And how do we change our culture?
And I think that comes down to some basic human elements, which, like I said before, an organization is at it fundamentally a group of individuals. So if we want to move and shift the thinking across an organization, we have to move and shift our own thinking. It can't be something that, yes, I think it's a great idea and you should go and do it. No. We've got to start by looking in the mirror. And I believe, and my own learnings along the way, we have to step away from our own sort of self-developed ego that says, I've been successful in all of the things I've done to get here, and therefore I know what everybody else needs to do.
Yeah.
Well, no, you've got to be humble enough to look in the mirror and look back at yourself and go, what is it that I need to do to become a better version of myself tomorrow than what I was yesterday? I think that's where it really starts. And, you know, across an organization as large as Roche, that's not an easy thing to do. And I would say we're all still on a journey, myself included.
Of course.
Yeah.
And I mean, that includes also acknowledging that I wasn't perfect yesterday.
Very much so. Yes.
And in a world which is so competitive, that's not easy. We all want to project that image, which is so perfect.
Yes.
Now, what I also find in particular interesting is that I think Roche has given enough freedom for different leaders to express their way of living agile in their own unique style and way. And you have taken it to a level which I think is also unique. In our recent discussion in Singapore, you shared that you felt a couple of years ago that you need to change to what you would call collective leadership.
Yes.
You wanted to kind of really share your responsibility between, I think, almost 30 of your most senior leaders. So what is collective leadership for you? How do you define that? Because it's a very interesting, powerful term.
I'm not sure I'd get a definition right. I mean, it's very simplistic level. It's saying it's a move away from an old school hierarchical model that might put, in my case, you know, Lance at the top of the APAC pyramid and everybody else doing their bit within it. But I'm in the command and control seat, right? And the way I described it to my team is well, no, that's not the case now, actually. What we're going to do is I'm stepping down from the top of the pyramid and I'm going to the bottom. And we're chopping the top off the pyramid, so it's not a peak anymore. It's a flat top, which means I'm exposing many more of my leaders to the dynamics of the world so they can grow. In other words, I'm getting out of the way to allow them to grow. And, you know, should they fall off, then I'm there to catch them and put them back. So it's a very, very different dynamic to an old school command and control, yet I'm not absolved of that responsibility or that guardianship of the APAC Roche Diagnostics business, our 6,000 plus people in the organization. I still have all of the responsibility and the accountability for that. Yet the collective leadership move means that I expect, but I also allow many other leaders of my own leaders to take the reins and move the train forward, if you like. I have to say that's not an easy personal shift for me. It was a growth process that took me a couple of years to go through, and I'm still working through it.
It's very courageous because I think the more successful, I would assume, you are in that process, the more likely it could be that people would find out, well, we can do without Lance. And therefore, we are doing very well. because they might not be noticing that you're actually holding their back, which you are constantly doing.
Yes.
Did you experience that these kind of traces of concerns?
Both at my level and also with my immediate team as well, yeah. Because at my own personal level, you know, I come back to what we talked about before, about our ego drives us a lot, and I'm a very competitive individual.
Yeah.
People who know me know that I am very competitive. And I like the challenge and I like the achievement. Mm. However, what you're doing is you're actively stepping away from being the first person across the finish line. Mm. The team might have propelled you there, but no, you're not going to be the first person across the finish line. Others will be, and you need to be comfortable as a leader to take the personal value of that experience lying in the fact that that's fantastic to see others winning or succeeding or however you want to define that. And maybe you had some contribution to it, but it's not about being in the front.
Yeah.
But it's always about being there to support. Never, ever. It's not about absolving, say, you guys do what you need to do. No, not at all. It's about establishing the guardrails and making sure that everybody knows that you've got their back and you'll guide and help. It's not about stepping away and letting the train run off on its own.
Right.
And then from an organizational perspective, my own leaders, I remember when I started on this, realized I had to shift my leadership style to allow others to grow and move into this collective leadership frame. I wrote a letter to my team explaining this is the journey I think I need to go on, so help me. And it was not easy. And a lot of people struggled to see which Lance was going to turn up. Is it the Lance that will take on their problems and be so-called Lance the Fixer? Or is it Lance the Shaper? Because they're used to Lance the Fixer. And then they get Lance the Shaper and they walk out going, oh, that's not what I wanted. Mm. And that took a lot of time. And I had some great conversations, feedback from one of my team in the moment, actually. And he came up to me in a coffee break in a meeting and he said to me, I want the old Lance back. So that transition is not necessarily an easy one. And you doubt yourself as a leader in those moments because you start to think, well, am I adding value here?
Yeah, yeah.
Am I adding value here? But now as I come through it, and I really want to articulate, make it really clear, I'm still on this journey.
Yeah.
I haven't worked it all out at all. But you do see others stepping into the space and growing because they have the space and the license and the support. And I think that's magical.
You sat down, you wrote the letter. What a beautiful situation. And I was wondering, what brought you to the point that you're going to decide, I'm changing my leadership style.
Yes.
I also know the direction of this change. I'm sitting down writing a letter. Mm. Was it through a coaching process? Was it something that you were encouraged by the organization? How did that evolve in yourself?
A few things, I would say. It was a moment in time as well. I had been, as I said, been in the company for a long time and had a number of general management roles across different countries. And then in 2012, became head of Asia Pacific. And, you know, after doing that for a number of years, you then start to wonder, well, am I still adding value? You know, you run a narrative and a model and a style. And I started thinking about, I guess, challenging myself on what value am I adding now? We've got many people who know how to drive a business, who know how to deliver for our patients and our customers. And am I just one more voice in the mix? Or is there a new space that will help the organization move forward? And it was a lot about what you touched on at the very beginning, the scope of the Asia Pacific region. We've got half the world's population, roughly. And so many, you've got millions of people who don't get access to healthcare. So with that as the backdrop, it then became, well, what can I do as a leader of Asia Pacific to make sure that the future for Roche Diagnostics has a strong APAC environment? And that was really what it was all about. So how can I make sure that I take whatever learning I've gained over the years and embed that in the system such that at some point in time, hopefully not soon, but at some point in time, I'm going fishing.
Yeah.
Right. And the system is strong. Mm. The leaders in APAC, the next generation. We have a philosophy within APAC. We would talk about plant trees we may never sit under.
Mm-hmm.
So we're empowered to do something today that will not necessarily serve me today, but will serve the system and the team at a later date. So it was these sorts of elements, along with some coaching from Paul Byrne, who I think you know Paul, and triggering some thoughts. Mm. And I realized that for me to add value to the organization and step into a different level, I had to change my narrative and my reason for creating value.
That's fascinating. And I believe one objective of collective leadership is to use also that collective wisdom, right? Mm. To really empower everyone. And I firmly believe that what really creates magic in a team is that energy, that consciousness, which is created.
Mm. Yes.
And in one way or the other, I think the whole is more than the sum of the parts,
yes.
Right? In both, in good or the bad way.
Yes.
I think we all have experienced situations where we enter a room, people don't want us to feel what was going on, but we sense there was a conflict.
Yes.
Or we enter into a room and we sense, what a great energy. I want to stay there.
Want to be part of that.
Right?
Mm.
Now, if, let's say, our viewers and listeners feel inspired, I'm quite sure they are, and they would like to bring that collective leadership into their teams.
Yes.
They will sit down, they will write a letter. And what
be
step,
careful.
What's step two and three? I mean, because it's a process which involves, as you said, changing the mindset.
Yeah.
People who have been rewarded for a certain type of behavior of year after year, they've been promoted for leading in a certain way, and now they receive a letter which informs them, as a Lance, I'm going to lead differently, and probably I'm going to expect you also to lead differently.
Yes. Yeah.
How did you take it forward?
Again, Christoph, I'm going to be very honest. I'm not saying it was all planned,
right?
You know, hindsight is 20/20, as we say. I think there was a few things that we had done that enabled what we have today to work. I think one of the things is organizations naturally tend to be very comfortable in talking about the mechanics of a business or whatever it is. It's the usual, you know, business plans, marketing plans, targets, execution. One half of the whole. I think for me, when I think about leadership in a general sense, I break it very simply down. By definition, a leader is somebody who's A, going in a direction, and B, by definition, has people following them. If there's no one following, they're not a leader. Mm. They're an individual walking down a pathway. So with that in mind, I've always been a big believer for my own self is, if I've got a leader, are they going in a direction that resonates with me, that I want to be part of?
Mm.
And are they a person who I'm comfortable with, or I feel I can learn from, or they have a value set I can connect with? So for us, we went through a process of creating what we call APAC Spirit, which is a set of characteristics that define us right across that big Asia Pacific region. And that anchors us today, even still. We did this many years ago, and it's really in our DNA of the way we think. But what it did do is it opened up the opportunity to have the other half of the conversation, which is what I call the human piece.
Mm.
And that's not to be personal or get into people's business or anything like that. But it is an understanding that the people in our organization are a complete package, and their delivery or the roles they're responsible for in the workplace is intimately connected with themselves as a whole. So I think this is one thing that then allows us to build trust. So I've had a team that's regularly being reshaped, but in a way in which things are built on, not extracted and plugged in. So things and people are built on, and it's an evolutionary process. The point is, a lot of the people in my leadership team, we've worked together for a long time. So I think one of the things that we were fortuitous in was there was a lot of trust already as a start point.
Yeah.
I think that's one. I think the other piece is being willing, and it's related to the human piece, being willing to have those honest conversations in the room. So I'll give you a great example. You want to create an environment in your organization where you're leveraging the diversity in the room, and so that you get good outcomes. So you want people contributing. And, you know, a lot of organizations will say, right, there's a rule set on how we will debate. We'll openly debate, for example. Now, in my world, and it's not exclusive to Asia Pacific, but I know there are cultures and individuals where that will not happen.
Yeah.
So we had a discussion around this in my collective leadership team of 34, where we said, well, what do we want to achieve here? We want to create an environment where, no, we don't want everybody talking at the same level, where we have to force people up to the most vocal individual in the room, because you have variations. But what we work very hard on is to create an honest, open conversation that allows for an environment when we come together where we know and acknowledge you might be more vocal than I am, but we work very hard as a collective, all of us, to make sure that the quieter individuals are good with the direction of the conversation. That might mean the person sitting next to us. So you might say to me, just quietly, Lance, are you good with this discussion? Mm. And I may be very fine. I'm not saying anything because I'm a quieter character.
Yeah.
But so long as the system allows for the quieter person who's very often got the gold that you're looking for, when they do want to participate, they are comfortable participating. Yeah. But we're not forcing everybody up. So I use that as an example of how we're acknowledging the human behavior and the differences in singular individuals. Those differences are driven by character and culture and many different things. But trying to create this organization when we are all in the room and we do a lot of time working in small groups, where there is some time spent constantly sharpening the saw, if you like, on making sure our system works.
Yeah.
And I think that's very, very important. And I think the other element is the initial conversation we had. So, you know, when we set this up, I talked a lot about guardrails and not rules.
Yeah.
We're all adults. Let's not treat adults like children, right? These are my senior leaders across the region. And so we're all adults. They're all running businesses in their own right. Create the guardrails, allow the teams the space to flex and move within that. But there are guardrails. So like I said before, it's not creating chaos. Guardrails, and then by sort of definition, guardrails provide a place where everybody's heading in a direction.
Yeah.
So what is that direction?
Yeah.
And very clearly, what did I mean by handing the keys to the car over, which is kind of what I did. And we talked about that at the beginning. I said, guys, it's like as a parent, it's my car, but I'm trusting you to drive it. I'm still responsible for it.
Yeah.
If something happens, the police are coming to me, but I'm trusting you to drive it. So the conversation we had was a very deliberate one. And I spoke to my 34 and the conversation we had was, for example, as a parent, your children get to a point where they've got their driver's license, but they may not have a car.
Mm.
So you entrust the keys to the car with the team. It's still my car. If something happens, the police are coming to me, but I trust that you guys will be able to drive the car. And in truth, you've then got 34 people instead of one.
Mm.
So it has to be better. It has to be more effective.
Yeah.
But we very specifically set it up that way. And we actually workshopped this over 3 days. The first, when we pulled this team together under this construct, we spent 3 days designing how it would work. And no content in the 3 days. We did not get into business discussions. We spent time creating a model that we believed would allow this to work. And even to the extent where the trust in the room was on day three, the team said, actually, Lance, the next conversation is better without you. Can you please leave? And I said, yes, of course. If the outcome requires me to leave, fantastic, no problems at all.
Wow.
So, like I say, the trust was there, but we're constantly building it and evolving it as we go.
So trust really as the basis for these discussions.
It is, because I think, and when I say trust, it's people getting to know each other. I can look you in the eye, and I can and I know where you stand on something. It's more than the mechanics of what you do.
For sure.
It's who you are.
Yeah.
And I think bringing that forth to allow trust to exist in a very human, honest way, that's the foundation by which you can move forward.
I love the image of you kind of handing over the keys and the car, which you still own, and where you still pay the insurance, and you're accountable for.
And nobody's crashed it, so that's good.
Exactly, and I was thinking of, as a young adult, my father also handed over the keys to me. I took very well care, yet once I came back with a scratch.
Yeah.
It was not my mistake, but there was a scratch.
It never is.
It never is, of course, and it didn't feel very good to admit to it, right? So what happened to your car?
The guys are doing a great job with it. I really have to say, I think what we're seeing is an unlocking of pace, actually.
Okay.
So we run this model whereby we take an agile approach. Yes, I've got the wisdom of my 34 who represent all of my 6,600 people. So none of my 6,600 people across the APAC region are in the shadow. They are all represented at my enabling team. But of course, that's a big team. And the way you can't make decisions with that many people in a room, absolutely not. So that's where the agile model comes in, where we take a topic, and the first question we ask is the topic right for this team and only this team to solve? If it's too tactical, we push it back into the system. We go, no, we're not taking that on. But if it's at the right strategic level and as part of our governance responsibilities, for example, we take that on, we create a small team around it, and they go and solve. They come back and they get feedback. And then when they bring their final model back into the group, we ask one singular question, all 34. Is there any reason why this can't be adopted? And it's very important, specific use of language. We're not getting into a discussion to say, well, you painted it blue, I would have painted it red. No, that's irrelevant. Is there any reason why this model cannot be adopted? So far, it's been great work, and the answer is yes. So you have multiple work product teams operating within the leadership team on an ongoing basis. And we're getting many more things done than everything flowing up through the old pyramid structure. So it's mobilizing people in an organized way to solve the right backlog problems that we as an enabling team have to deal with on a regular basis. So far, we're all kind of looking at each other a little bit and going, wow, this model's working, and it's a bit of fun.
And I can feel that vibe, and I know it is successful. I mean, people at Roche are talking about it as a best practice. And in the same time, leadership is something intangible in many ways. Mm-hmm. And we are always looking for KPIs to measure impact.
Yes.
Have you been able to kind of look at some metrics, or have you been able to study impact at least to a certain degree?
I would be honest and say, no, we're not measuring that yet. I think that might evolve.
Yeah.
As time goes on. But what I would say is there's been key elements that would have taken us years to move forward that we've moved forward in a matter of months.
Yeah.
Things like developing our young in career talent, for example. A small team's been working the right people around the table with our global colleagues who are very supportive of the various initiatives that we have. And we're getting solutions, we're getting outcome, we're getting traction that we haven't been able to in the past. So I see that as an indicator, for example, of success. I think the other one is the role my APAC leaders now play on the global stage. In other words, it's not Lance speaking for APAC. It's my leaders bringing their experience, which is phenomenal, into the broader Roche organization, which is hugely valuable for the organization as a whole, because we're unlocking talent and knowledge and experience that's there but we're giving them a license to participate. And culturally, that's often a big challenge to get past.
Yeah.
So early indications, there's some real shining lights that I look at and go, yeah, this is exciting. We're getting some wins on the board.
And I would assume that surely then also increases the engagement, right?
Exactly.
Of your people.
Yes. Yeah. We could never have run this model. I want to be clear. You could never have run this model without adopting, in our case, some fundamental agile tools to make the model work.
Yeah.
You can't suggest in an old management style approach to have 34 people in the room. So I think it's important that we understand that to allow this model that we're running to work, we've had to adopt tools that we never had 10 years ago. And only with those tools can this operate.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Truly impressive. So maybe what would you say are maybe your one or two key lessons learned from that journey, which is still ongoing? Mm-hmm. I get that. But just as you have a balcony moment that we're sitting here in Switzerland reflecting on it.
There's a lot of learnings, and we've touched on a few of the elements. I think also being honest that the journey we went on is an experiment, and I framed it as an experiment.
Yeah.
To an extent, it still is.
Mm.
We're still learning. We're still learning how to make it work. But that then sets an expectation of everybody in the experiment. So are we expecting perfection on day three? No, we're not. But creating the environment where, in the spirit of collective leadership, we all own the success of the experiment or the outcomes of the experiment. So if something's not working, well, you can fix it.
Mm.
Or you can have a conversation and bring the solution to the table. It's empowering. But I think a really important piece is setting the expectation. If people come in and expect to drop into a model and have it very structured and rigid and a clear output at the end, they'll be disappointed. They have to be comfortable working through the process and learning along the way and then changing our behaviors along the way on the basis of what we learn.
Yeah.
I think that's very important.
I'm sure many of our viewers and listeners, they will say, well, this is truly inspiring. I would like to model or find my own way of living what Lance is living and doing. And, you know, from outside, I think many a times these leadership journeys, they look very linear.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's basically moving from one success to the other.
Mm.
But then again, when we look closer, it's much more, at least to me, about how we deal with the setbacks. We are both sports fans, I believe.
Yes.
You're doing a lot of sports. I'm watching a lot of sports on TV. But, you know, I followed, for example, closely the career of the great Roger Federer.
Right.
Yeah. Here in Switzerland, we all admire him.
Yes.
Now, statistics would say he lost about 46 to 47 of all points he ever played on the tennis field, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, wait a moment. He won so many matches, but he had to deal with losing almost every second point.
Yes.
And the way he dealt with it obviously was amazing, right? And helped him to be who he was amongst, of course, other gifts.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask, were there moments where you kind of really fell down, where you felt maybe that's it? And what made you go through that? What helped you to be resilient?
I think we touch a little bit on our own characters as well, and in this. And in my case, what I've learned over the years, I'm very. In fact, when I say over the years, in the recent years, I've realized something about my character, which is, I'm very comfortable and in many ways look towards doing things that others may not have.
Mm.
I talked about building a house when I was 23 years old, for example. Many people thought I was absolutely crazy as general manager of Roche Diagnostics in New Zealand, going to India. Why would you do that? Challenge is a big thing for me, and being comfortable if something hasn't been done before, then, okay, we'll find the pathway or create the pathway. So I know that's a motivator for me. And I guess with that as the sort of backdrop, then, okay, could you utilize the richness of my team, the people around me? I have tremendous faith and trust in the people around me to create a new governance or enabling team model. So there was courage in that with the people around me. yes, the journey and the setbacks, I very much look at, and it sounds cliche, but okay, got that wrong. What do I learn? And do it differently next time. And I wouldn't even go as far as to say do it right next time. I'd say do it differently next time. And maybe you get it wrong a second time, but okay, try it a third way. So in the spirit, you have to, in order to do that, I think you've got to step away from my younger mindset of I have to win every time to a mindset that says I have to learn to be better on the journey. I still like to win. Of course, that's in my makeup and in my character. So I'm not stepping away from that. But in a way, in a sense, it's a richer way to allow, hopefully, us to win in the future.
And that's what I would call a growth mindset, really, right? Which is that something you have trained yourself into, or is that, would you say you had that?
I've learned.
I've
learned as a more senior leader because I was very driven by here's what I've been able to do, here's my achievements, drive, success, win the game, win the battle, whatever it is, win the race. And in doing so, good, validation. So it's a hard thing to step away from. And in a sense, you've got to reframe the driver to be successful, however you define success, but reframe that to one that says learn, which is different to train. So I played a lot of sport when I was younger and still try and stay relatively fit. And a big part of that was you knew the game, train, hit thousands of shots, whatever it is, to hone that skill to be able to play the game better. Whereas I think this journey is about seeking input, you know how to play the game, but seeking input to learn how to play the game differently to be better. And I think that sometimes our egos trip us up.
Absolutely. And that's something, I think that mindset allows us, this growth mindset allows us to remain playful in these moments, which are so important because, yes, we want to win.
Yes.
But just because it is so important that we create so much pressure on winning right now, we tighten up and then obviously we are not the best version of ourselves.
And look, there are times, right, when sometimes you go, actually, we don't have this piece is so critical. No, I am going to be all over this with the team and we're all going to make sure that happens without a mistake. We have to be honest. You know, there are times like that. And I think as a leader, in empowering your people, there's also a skill in knowing, you know what, the learning for that individual is more important than the outcome because we can always bring it back in and go again. And I think that's an important part of leadership for people to think about in their own leadership journeys and how they manage their teams.
Absolutely. And maybe to stay with Roger Federer, you know, when he started to lose even the big games where he had a time where he was almost invincible and he started losing against Nadal and Djokovic. And even after losing, for example, Wimbledon after five sets and it was grueling, he used to say in press conferences and the Swiss media had a big debate afterwards, has he lost his cutting edge? You know, he just used to say, yes, I'm really disappointed, I'm sad, I'm upset. And then came usually a very interesting sentence that was difficult to understand. He used to say, but I learned a lot. Yes. I gained a lot of data.
It's a learning.
And then the media was many times writing and saying, you know, he has lost it. He has lost his competitive edge.
Yes.
But I think he had that growth mindset and cultivated that. And that made him so great for such a long time.
To build on that, if I reflect, you asked me earlier on sort of who's been influential or who have I learned from. What's really interesting is the gift for me in this collective leadership journey is also I see my team doing things that I'm learning from as well. So you're unlocking this creativity and this excellence and allowing people to create their own pathways to solutions of the problems we have to deal with. And I go, wow, that's a really cool way to deal with that. So again, it's almost a continuous loop because we learn from those around me. And a lot of the learning I get on a daily basis now is from my team in observing how they're operating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if we have a very positive mindset or a growth mindset, when we are tired, when we are exhausted, when we haven't eaten or slept, it's difficult. It's difficult to be the best version of ourselves. And you do all of that, right? You travel across time zones. Asia Pacific is huge. And then you have to come to Switzerland, obviously. Yeah. You have back-to-back meetings. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you manage your diet. And in the same time, whenever I meet you, you're fresh. Of course, you must be tired sometimes, but you have a certain level of high energy. You're fit physically, mentally. Mm. What are your secrets to the success, to manage yourself? Not your 6,600 people, but yourself.
Myself. I don't know. My guys might tell me I'm not always full of energy or in a positive mindset. But I think the thing is, acknowledge that we're all individual. For me, I do train. I commit 3 hours a week to the gym. Yeah. Strength and conditioning training, and that's a very important thing at two levels. One is from the health perspective, but I mentioned earlier on I'm a competitive individual now. I don't play sport anymore competitively, but that allows me to have an environment where I can indulge that competitiveness, even if it's against myself. So, and did we hit our numbers? I work with a trainer. Did we hit our numbers? Are we on the journey that I want us to go on? So that's an outlet, and it's important, I think, to have an outlet. My children are grown up, and my grandchildren are in New Zealand, and I'm in Singapore, and so I also have time. I mean, we're at different phases in our lives. We've got young families where you don't have that luxury. So I don't think there's one recipe. But I think understanding what fills your cup versus what drains your cup. And COVID was a great example, and my wife reminded me of this. And we in diagnostics in Roche, of course, were at the white hot center of COVID. You mentioned it earlier on. And, you know, very difficult trying to, as we were, the guys were ramping up production, doing incredible things. And the world screaming for more tests. And there was a period of time where it was very, very difficult. That kept us very, very focused. But of course, for me, my wife reminded me as I was getting frustrated in year two around the fact that my energy comes from being with my teams and my people and our customers.
Yeah. Yeah.
That fills my cup.
Mm.
Without being able to travel in COVID, of course, Asia was shut down.
Yeah.
I was not getting that.
Yeah.
And so somebody pointed that out to me, and it was very true.
Mm.
And often the most honest feedback we get is from our spouses. And she articulated that through, and that made me acutely aware of, actually, that's very true. So I now know what fills my cup and what drains my cup, and making sure that I'm aware of that. So, yes, I travel a lot. But the beauty is when I land, I get that energy from the teams, you know, and the conversations that I have. But I do need time for myself on my own, and that manifests itself on a weekly basis, which is three training sessions a week. And when my truly happy place, as my team knows well, is when I'm back in New Zealand, family's there, which is fantastic, and I'm on the boat catching some fish. That's actually my happiest place. So,
And I can literally feel. I can.
Yeah, you probably. Yeah, I get excited.
Feel
about
it.
That.
I can see it. I've never been to New Zealand. It's one of the places. You know, here in Switzerland, when we're young, we talk about Australia, New Zealand. I've not been there.
Well, on behalf of tourists in New Zealand, I encourage you to go.
But I had the pleasure once to go fishing, actually, for 2 months with my best friend at that time. When I was about 20 in Finland, that was an amazing experience. So I can relate to
2 months fishing. That'd be heaven for me. I like that a lot.
It was great. Surely something for the mind also, right? Being in the present moment is so vitally important. Maybe just being with that one activity of nothing happening right now.
Yes. Yeah. I find, and probably many of us are like this, is when we're in the busyness of the day-to-day, the week-to-week, the month-to-month, reflection is often quite difficult. And I have a couple of small routines that I have. We learned through leadership training and just a 5-minute habit in the morning when I get up and have a cup of coffee and I'm on my own. I just do it an internal sense check of how am I today?
Mm.
Because I learned that how I show up in the office
yeah.
or in meetings, if I've had a bad night's sleep and I'm grumpy, well then that so it's just a pause to go, it's really how am I today? And then is that how I need to be?
Yeah.
So it's that's an every morning dynamic. And then the other thing that I try and do at the end of every week is I mentioned we have a descriptor of how we in APAC like to behave.
Yeah.
It's known as APAC spirit. And I try and regularly reflect back on how have I met those? So again, it's a look in the mirror. So this was a commitment to the team. And have I lived that commitment in the last week? And you kind of reflect back and go, well, in that meeting I did pretty well, but in the other one, no, I didn't do so well. So it's constantly trying to hold yourself to an improvement process, become a better version of ourselves, as we say.
Yeah. You're sitting there 5 minutes in the morning to really be with yourself, being present. And I think that aspect of pausing.
Yes.
In that constant attempt to run and run faster is so vitally important. We can call it being mindful, being present.
I wouldn't go as far as to say I'm clever enough to reshape my headspace in that 5 minutes. Yeah. But it's acknowledging and knowing, be careful, Lance, you're a bit reactive today.
Yeah.
So, and then that's sort of front of mind as you enter into the space. And don't get it right a lot of the time, but... I actually found that quite a powerful tool.
Moments of self-awareness.
Yes.
Even rather acknowledging that I might be reactive today already. I mean, I'm on the balcony, and so I can intervene potentially.
Yeah.
We started with that notion of you being the young Lance and what your parents would have told or thought about you. And I was thinking to close with that idea of, what would you advise yourself if you would meet yourself maybe at the age of 20? And we would think that with that experience that you have gained, you could advise yourself at that age so that maybe certain mistakes you don't need to do, you could learn more directly. Or, of course, for us here, we can learn from you in terms of how to be one's best version.
Yes. There's a temptation to go and want to advise in the form of erasing all of the errors.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that because, again, with the knowledge and that I have now, then those were learning and shaping opportunities. So in that sense, I wouldn't. I would make the same mistakes again or let my younger self make those mistakes. However, what I would say, and maybe this is something of growing up in New Zealand, which is not a small country, but a small population, far, far away from the rest of the world, I would encourage myself to have a bigger view of the world as a 20-year-old, because that's the gift that I really treasure in my journey with Roche over the years and operating across many different cultures in the APAC environment. It's just broadened my view of the world tremendously, and I see that as I'm extremely grateful for that personally. And so that might be my advice. The world is a very big place. Be curious to the 20-year-old Lance, and then go and make all the mistakes that you can.
Wow. Thanks a lot for that. And I think I can feel that you're living life with that curiosity. And you have been so curious to endeavor into a new leadership journey, collective leadership journey. Thank you so much for sharing your curiosity and your insights with us.
Pleasure.
I was curious how this discussion will evolve.
Me too. I didn't know where we were going to go.
I'm very, very happy. Thanks
Excellent.
A lot.
Thanks, Christoph. Thanks. Look, really appreciate the opportunity.
Really appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Thank you. Very happy you joined. As always, if you feel, subscribe to the channel. Stay tuned and all the best.